Welcome to the first panel. I think I want to start with giving a couple of opinions myself. I think the goal that we have as molecular microscopists is to get the best possible data to understand some important biological question. And what we're about to discuss, or what we're going to discuss over the next few days, is what might be limiting us, and ideally we'd like to come up with some sorts of experiments that will point the way forward. Today's panel will focus on two subjects, and we're sort of asking a couple of questions. Do we really understand what's happening when we make a thin film in the microscope? And are there ways that we can improve the result to get better preservation or better quality of images? And the second subject is, you know, what happens when we irradiate a frozen film, particularly with respect to charging and or beam-induced specimen movement? And are there things that we can do in that respect to improve the percentage of really great images that we obtain? I mean, now we hear sort of depressing report from the real experts that, you know, 1% of images are perhaps good, and then Yoshi tells us 95% of images are good. Actually, probably at the end, I have an idea about why 95% are good. And if we have time, we can get to that. But first, I want to react to a couple of statements that were made this morning. And one of... I want to caution you about a couple of statements that were made this morning. The first statement that was made, which I think requires some thought and some reflection, is that you know, it might be worthwhile looking at specimens in crystalline ice. And I think that's a really bad idea, and I'm going to explain why I think that's the case. And the second thing that came up this morning was that there was an indication that it was useful or good in certain circumstances to use evaporation to thin the layer sufficiently to make a good ice specimen. And I think using evaporation is, in many cases, a really bad idea. And I'll explain why that is. And after I've done that and had some response from the audience, Bob is going to make a short... James Chen is going to make a short presentation on low dose rate imaging, a really nice piece of work that he's done in Nico's lab. And then Bob will give a short introduction to what we know about specimen preparation. So my first, I have a couple of slides that I just culled from an old presentation about how to make frozen specimens. And this is to do with, it was originally to do with freezing rates, but it's appropriate for the thing that I'm concerned about, and illustrates why I think that looking at things in ice crystals is really bad. So what happens with slow freezing is that you get a few points of nucleation here of ice crystals, and these growing ice crystals recruit water and only water from the surrounding solution, and the result is that you get these large areas of pure ice crystal and this very thick eutectic in between, which contains, first of all, your specimen, and secondly, concentrated salts and perhaps, you know, things that have changed the pH. And this is actually, this process is used industrially to make frozen orange juice. So, you know, they squeeze the oranges in Florida, and it's really expensive to transport lots of water around the country. So they just cool it down and grow these large ice crystals. And the eutectic is the stuff that they package up in those little jars or those little canisters that you find in the freezer in Vaughan's. So that's what your specimen is ending up being embedded in if you use hexagonal ice. Probably not a good thing. At intermediate freezing rates, you get cubic ice. And the piece of work that was referred to this morning was, I think, down in Werner's lab, where they looked at TMV that was embedded in cubic ice. And I think the conclusion was that they were perfectly well preserved. But I would argue that, first of all, TMV is a very special specimen. It's practically not biological. uh, And I think that the same thing is happening here. You're getting, the only difference being that you're getting lots of nucleation and you get small ice crystals. But this frozen orange juice is still there in between those ice crystals and cannot be good for your specimen. And what you really want, of course, is amorphous ice where it's very structureless and everything is distributed as it was in solution. The other disadvantage with imaging things in these crystalline ice media is that you add a lot of noise. So here's amorphous ice over here and the diffraction pattern. Here's cubic ice here and the powder pattern from the microcrystals. And here's the large single crystals of hexagonal ice over here. So that was work that I did many years ago. And this is from one of Jacques Dubuchet's papers in the early 80s, I think. Again, amorphous ice down here, cubic ice. That adds an incredible amount of noise to your image. And the hexagonal ice over here. So that's the opinion. Here's a little piece of data that I collected many, many years ago. This is a ribosome crystal here. And we started out with the ribosome crystal nicely embedded in amorphous ice. This is dying, by the way, or dead. If you take a diffraction pattern of this area, it's not terribly well ordered, but you get nice, sharp diffraction spots which extend out to about 50 angstroms resolution. If you take an electron diffraction pattern from that area, nice amorphous ice evident in the diffraction pattern. You warm this up in the microscope to higher than 130 degrees centigrade, and you get a phase transition from amorphous to cubic ice, and you get this sort of granular sandy appearance which covers the whole image. I don't have the diffraction pattern of the ribosome crystal, but what actually happened was that not only did the resolution of the diffraction pattern get worse, but the spots got really fuzzy. So the crystallization of the ice really destroyed this crystal. Now, this is a particularly sensitive crystal because it had great big holes in it between the ribosomes. So presumably what was happening was that these little ice crystals were nucleating in the holes and disrupting it as they grew. It's perfectly possible, as is probably the case with TMV, that there's not enough space between the subunits to get nucleation. And so the whole thing is just simply freeze-dried in a way and excluded from the ice, and is possibly particularly well-preserved in under those circumstances. So, but I think, I want to repeat again, I think TMV is a very unusual specimen in many respects. And so the continuation of the experiment was I took it from minus 130 up to about minus 80 degrees centigrade, and you don't actually see the conversion from cubic to hexagonal in the microscope because it occurs at about minus 90, I think, or minus 100. And at that point, everything sublimes in the microscope. So that was just a cautionary note about the idea of freezing specimens or observing specimens in crystalline ice. I don't really think it's a good idea. The second cautionary note is to do with evaporation, using evaporation to thin specimens down to suitable thicknesses for freezing and then imaging. And this is an old slide again, just which illustrates the way that I used to make specimens. I don't actually make specimens anymore, but I used to make them this way. So here's a grid, here's the carbon film, here's a drop of liquid on the grid, and here's the filter paper pressed up against the grid surface. And what happens is that you get contact between the liquid and the filter paper, and the excess liquid is wicked away into the filter paper. The filter paper is pulled in towards the grid surface, and then at some point, enough of it gets wicked away that the contact between the grid surface and the filter paper breaks. And you can see that by simply looking, you know, from that direction over there. You can see the change in the color of the filter paper. And that's the point at which we would whip the filter paper away and freeze. And that's the point at which evaporation comes into play. And so in the half second or however long it takes between you taking away the filter paper and it plunging into liquid ethane, there is evaporation taking place, and it's very significant. And there are two problems with that. One is that the solutes are concentrating. You know, your salt concentration is going up. Your pH may be changing. And the other thing, which is important, perhaps you know, of minor importance for most things, but one thing that I worked on was microtubules, and that is that you get evaporative cooling. And so, long story was that we were trying to freeze microtubules from 37 degrees, and we never understood why they were always breaking down. And the fact was that in the half second, the liquid drop, or the liquid on the surface of the grid, was dropping by about 10 degrees centigrade due to evaporative cooling. But the more important thing is that the solutes are concentrating. And, you know, you may think, oh, you know, what can happen in half a second? Well, a lot can happen in half a second, and I just want to show you this. This is actually work that was done by Ken Taylor, I think for his thesis many, many years ago, and I don't know if it was ever published, but he, at one point, was kind enough to give me a box of reprints, and hidden in the box of reprints was his calculations, and I've been showing them ever since. No, you calculated it. It's all, I have it all upstairs. I'll show you. You are to blame. It was a long time ago. Okay, so here we are today. We're at 25 degrees C in this room. The relative humidity is about 60%, let's say. Water is evaporating from the surface, any surface, at a rate of 800, roughly, angstroms per second. That's pretty amazing. So whenever you freeze something in the lab, in the half second that it takes, let's say, for the grid to drop after you pull the blotter away, to drop into the ethane, you've lost 400 angstroms of thickness. And that's pretty significant if you're trying to make something that's 1,000 or maybe 500 angstroms thick to begin with. So you have to reduce that, in my mind, by going to 4 degrees centigrade. As Clint said, I would get in the cold room and I would boil a kettle in the cold room at night to get the humidity up somewhere up here. So again, the cautionary note, people don't appreciate how fast water is evaporating from a surface and how that can really affect what's happening in a thin film of liquid. It's very evident if you try and freeze something like muscle thick filaments, which are incredibly sensitive to changes in salt concentration. If the salt concentration goes up above about 200 to 250 millimolar potassium, they just depolymerize. There is no way you will get a good picture of a muscle thin filament by freezing at room temperature at 25 degrees C and 60% relative humidity. I have never been able to do it. It's practically impossible. You have to go into the cold room, or you have to use a Vitrobot. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say. Are there some questions about that particular part? Sure. So, Josh is running mics for me here, so please use the microphone. So, and don't address your question to me. Address the the assembled multitude.
Yeah. So, Ron, you talked about the evaporation thing, and because I saw everybody know when we brought the sample, we used filter paper. Do anybody think that the filter paper will also have some effect on the sample? Because sometimes I notice that different filter paper may have different material in it, maybe different magnesium, calcium, something different, and they may also have certain effect on the sample you prepared, especially for like a microtubule, like a kinesin, like for filament, muscle fiber.
Absolutely.
They are very sensitive to calcium or magnesium.
Wattman, number one filter paper contains sufficient calcium to activate muscle thin filaments as you're blotting. I know for a fact. You have to treat it with EGTA and then dry it out again. So that's another thing to be aware of. That's that's what I know about, is the calcium in the filter paper. There may be other things which are affecting your specimen as well.
So different filter papers will blot at different rates. So sometimes you may want to blot slower, so you might want to change depending on what you're doing.
Ken?
So one of the advantages of that back blotting thing that Debbie described for the monolayer is that the monolayer covers the free side. So that greatly retards evaporation on the free side. So you can make those kind of specimens in the cold, but you don't need that.
Yeah, Yeah, and presumably the second carbon film that Yoshi, the method that Yoshi described this morning, also retards the evaporation. Anything else here?
Can I ask you, how did you solve the problem for the cooling problem before you had the vapor bath? And it's always just 10 degrees.
Yeah, that was
For the microtubule.
So this was about 1990, and I was doing some work with the Mandelkos, and we were trying to image the ends of microtubules, growing microtubules and shrinking microtubules. And microtubules are temperature sensitive, so if you don't control the temperature, if you don't keep the temperature at 37 degrees, they depolymerize. And we were unable to see growing microtubules until we realized that the temperature was dropping. What we did, we commandeered a warm room at 37 degrees, and we boiled kettles in the warm room to raise the relative. We essentially did it in a steam room. And it was very, very uncomfortable. But it worked. It would be much easier now with the Vitrobot. Tom? Oh, we just had a tiny thermocouple, which we put in the drop on the 5 microliter drop, and no, we didn't plunge it. But if you put a couple of microliters on a grid at room temperature and put a thermocouple in, the thermocouple measures 5 to 10 degrees lower than the ambient temperature. And of course, at 37 degrees and low relative humidity, it's much more because the evaporation is much faster. Bob.
The macroscopic version of that is the historical way to measure relative humidity. You have a thermometer, put water on it.
Wet bulb and dry bulb thermometers, yes. Over here?
If I remember right, the first paper they published for freezing, the field paper is supposed to be on the back door of the grid. So that actually every liquid will go through the hole. And your method, actually later, I also use this method from the front of the grid to suck the water out. Do you think there's different? Also, now visuals actually is a sandwiching method.
I'm not sure. There's a difference. I mean, some people blot from the back, some people blot from the front. Does anyone have an opinion?
I tried it from back and from forth, and I don't get really a difference. But what I think is really an advantage to put it as a sandwich, because it is mechanical, you don't have so much bending of the grid. If you go from one side, you always bend your grid a little bit. So I think that's the main advantage of sandwich plotting.
Okay, James, do you want to tell us about, where is he? Low dose rate imaging.
First of all, I would like to thank Ron, Bob, and Nico, the panel, and also Bridget and Clint, the organizer of this workshop, for the yes, Lisa. Yes, I would like to thank these people for the opportunity for presenting the research we have done in Nico's group. Basically, we studied the photography of electron microscopy. And namely, the lighting, the shutter speed, and the aperture setup. The perimeter space is huge. So what we focused on is on the dose rate. Of course, in cryo, single part of cryo electron microscopy, we want to use low dose. And from there, we also noticed that a low dose rate would help to obtain high quality images. So in the next few minutes, I'm thinking to present you with a few experimental observations, and the interpretation of those facts are open for discussion. I want to discuss beam-induced specimen movement, bubbling, and radiation damage. Bubbling and the radiation damage, they are related, but bubbling, we look at that as a secondary effect. And by radiation damage, I mean the breaking of chemical bonds, which is the direct damage to the protein structure. So first experiment I want to present is to study the specimen movement. For this study, we used nanogold, colloidal gold, about 10 nanometers in diameter, embedded in vitreous ice, and we took two exposures, and then study the particle movement between these two exposures. So this is the first exposure, the second exposure. Because of the lack of a stationary frame of reference, the specimen under the beam irradiation, everything can move. So we don't have a stationary frame of reference. So it's difficult to come up with a fixed coordinates to measure the location of the particles. So eventually, we decided to use the distance change between particle pairs to measure this relative movement. The distance movement is measured by the change between D1 and D2, D1 minus D2. So the order of this operation is important, which is obvious in these statistics. So we put gold particles into the vitreous ice, and for each micrograph, we have about 10 particles, and we calculate the distance change pairwise. So we have about 200 several hundred, actually, pair statistics, distance statistics. And we make the subtraction, D1 minus D2, and plot that as a function of the particle pair distance. So on the x-axis, it is the distance between pair and, I think this is dying. All right. Y-axis is the distance change, D1 minus D2. And from here, I tested this protocol under two setups. One is the conventional beam illumination, namely about 10 to 15 electron per angstrom square per second, and the shutter speed is controlled at 1 second exposure. And the second setup is a low dose rate at 1.5 electrons per angstrom square per second, and to equalize the dose on the image, we use 10 second exposure. As a result, we plot this, and we will notice immediately that for the low dose imaging, the distance change is smaller, noticeably smaller. And if we make another plot, the same data, but build up a histogram, we notice that the spread of this change is smaller for Linda comparing to the conventional high flux setup. And also, another fact we notice here is the skewness of this histogram. It is skewed towards the positive side because the distance change we measure is D1 minus D2. So that means this positive skewness means the entire ice system actually contracts from the first exposure to the second exposure. So this is the first experimental observation we had for comparing the different illumination intensity. The second effect we observed is specimen the ice bubbling, the specimen bubbling. If I use the same setup, the same defocus setup, and
it costs $19.95.
Thanks, Bridget. So I still control the same dose on each image frame, varying the intensity and exposure time. This is at 10 electrons per angstrom square per second, and this is 1, but the exposure would last for 10 seconds. This is the first shot. They look similar. And then, for each imaging condition, over the same region of interest, the second exposure. And we can see some apparent difference here first. Oh, by the way, this is TMV. The specimen is TMV. I should have brought up this earlier. So it becomes smoother. The appearance becomes smoother. And here we can still see the central channel, which is about 40 angstrom in diameter. And second thing we noticed is the ice droplets here. In the first frame, they are about the same similar distribution. And the second one, after 20 electrons per angstrom, square deposition, for the high dose rate irradiation, the ice droplets almost disappeared. But this still not very much change. For the third exposure, up to this stage, in each image, the dose accumulation is around 30 electrons per angstrom square. And here, we have noticeable bubbling already. And for the low dose rate condition, this image is almost comparable to the first exposure. So this is the second experimental observation we have about bubbling. The third experiment we carried out, we performed, is to study the radiation damage on the specimen. This is the TMV. So first set of observation is we just use the contrast of this rod to see the damage. Because it has this 40 angstrom channel, and we just visually check this. This is a qualitative way of looking at things. The central channel disappears gradually in the high flux setup, and the central channel is still visible in the third shot under the linear condition, and also the ice droplets again, this. But this is just a qualitative way of doing this. And then we switch to a more quantitative way of measuring the power spectrum. To do that, we collect data on a Polaro electron microscope from Christine Spang's group. With their help, we collected a set of data under several different defocus setup. And we build up some statistics. Let me explain this power spectrum. So for each TMV segment rod, we cut them into segments, 575 angstrom in length. The idea is to have multiple repeats. One complete repeat for TMV, it's not one complete, but one turn is 23 angstroms. So 575 is an exact multiple of that. We cut them into small segments, and for each segment, we calculate the power spectrum, and we will get layer lines. So these are 2D layer lines, and we add them up together for image in each group. We add them up together with CTF correction. We want to get rid of the CTF zero crossing, and so these two setup can be compared directly. But still, this is 2D power spectrum, and to simplify the analysis, we made a projection perpendicular to the TMV axial direction. So now we have 1D, and we plot this. We find a way to normalize the spectrum by equalizing the first peak. And then, just by comparing the relative strength of the second peak, third peak, we notice the improvement in the signal information recorded in the MagRaph from the Linda imaging setup. And also for Linda, we have some minor peaks which extend to the higher resolution of the power spectrum. So this is an indication that under the Linda setup, we obtain more information in the image MagRaph. We're not saying that the particle itself or the protein molecule itself is intact, is immune from radiation damage. What we think is radiation damage still occurs, and it should be related to the total dose. But the question is, are those damage somehow diffused to the surroundings to change the overall shape, or that damage is still localized? So at the resolution we are observing, the specimens of the power spectrum is still behaving nicely. So this is a question for discussion later on.
Excuse me, what temperature was this experiment at?
This is in cryo, so normally it is 180, between 180, 181.
Have you tried a liquid helium temperature?
No, we haven't tried this. This is in liquid nitrogen temperature. Yes.
Is this the first exposure or second exposure?
This is from the first exposure, comparing the Linda and Heflux, yes. So basically, these are the three experimental observations we have had. And I think just a quick, quickly go through the potential applications for single particle. Because of the improvement in the signal, we can have better alignment. And also, it seems that this technique can be used for multiple exposures, for example, tilt data. Random conductivity or orthogonality reconstruction, and also maybe a pseudo cryo electron tomography, which means we can collect, say, two or three frames at larger angular separation and put them back together. And one caveat of this technique, it requires a very stable cryo stage. But as the Polaro and the Titan microscope, that level of instruments are becoming increasingly accessible, this technique may be readily usable. And also, this technique can be easily integrated into automated data collection system like Legendome. So I just want to conclude my talk again. Thank the organizer and Nico for the opportunity to come here and present the research.
So how did you change the intensity of the beam between the higher dose rate versus the lower dose rate?
Right. There are several ways to do this. Using a smaller aperture, C2 aperture, that's one way of doing this, and to change the spot size of the intensity, so we can control the intensity.
Do you think that affected the coherency of the beam or any of that?
It should. And for smaller C2 aperture, the coherence should be further improved. But here we're using F30 and Polara, FEG basically, to collect data. But even with that, smaller C2 aperture would help to have better envelope function at higher frequency domain, and that should help. Yes.
It's my recollection that experiments like this have been done on 2D crystals a number of years ago. Does anyone remember what the results were? Or?
Well, we have done some experiments which we took picture around 60 seconds when we used to work on the 2D crystal. It was a very long exposure time. Something like 60 seconds, extremely low dose rate. And those are really nice image, but since then there was no microscope that would allow us to take pre-ensemble images at 60 seconds. Yoshi, could you take images 60 seconds?
Yeah, I did. 16 second exposure.
No, 60. 60.
No, 16. Not 60, sorry. No, but gives a very nice data, but success ratio is not so high. So, you know, we can get, when we try, and then we will, we could get a very nice image, but we need many images, so I gave up longer exposure. Because, you know, gradually success ratio is reduced when you extend exposure time. Then we are now using 2 seconds much easier. So, yeah.
So if I could repeat Clint's question in a more blunt form, do you think, yes, do you think the improvement was entirely due to the tenfold increase in coherence?
Uh,
That's really what Clint was asking, very tactfully, I think.
How to measure the improvement of coherence? I mean, it's a tenfold. What will be the criteria to measure that?
You expanded the beam, and it must be 10 times.
No, I don't. I can answer maybe. I don't think so because the resolution he's dealing with is very deep and low, right? So the spatial coherence shouldn't be affected at that spatial frequency. So I just wonder.
Defocus. Sure. Yes. Because of that, we didn't use very high defocus. So for the TMV's power spectrum, we used mainly three groups of defoci: 1.5, 2.5, and 3.5. So we kept in mind that the parallel of the beam would be changed when we change defocus. But just from our experience, changing from 0 to 3 micron defocus, the change in the parallelism is tolerable. Yeah.
I just wonder. I should say, because we measured this, we looked at the tone rings from the carbon under the two different settings, just to see if there's a stronger envelope.
Indeed, yes. No.
At 8 angstroms, right, where we see the difference in the TMV layer.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Long, you asked 2D crystal. But in case of 2D crystal, we don't need this technique because we need 3 angstrom image. Then we can make an atomic model. Then we can phase extend by diffraction pattern. So.
Useful for 2D. I was saying that I remember, I don't know what else, that similar experiments were done many, many years ago, and what the results of those were. I recall that there was no difference.
Yes, I think that's right.
I had a couple of this sort of thoughts. One was the 1 second exposure is a very short exposure. And when you are you sure you've got your, you don't do any pre-irradiation, because that will have a more significant effect on the image than the 10-second exposure. You know, a quarter of a second pre-irradiation with a very bright beam as opposed to a quarter of a second with a dim beam.
Right.
So unless you've got, you're absolutely sure you've got that right. The other thing was that, actually, we did experiments along similar lines, either me and Chikashi or me and John Berryman. You know, we were interested in taking pairs of pictures of our acetylcholine receptor tubes, and what we noticed was if you take the second of a pair, say 5 minutes later, it'd be a terrible image, whereas if you took it just straight afterwards, it'd be a very good image. And we assumed that so that meant the sort of radical damage or something occurring, you know, while the no radiation's occurring at all. So in that sense, you might be worried that a low dose rate might be worse because it would increase the time for radical damage.
Okay. So for the radical damage, it is mainly from the diffusion of the radicals to the surrounding neighbors. And our explanation is at a lower dose rate, the diffusion, because the concentration increased per time unit, the concentration increase would be much slower in low dose. In that case, the concentration is lower. And as a result, the diffusion, because diffusion is affected by the concentration difference, and the diffusion would be slower. And the second thought would be, because it is slower, the radical would have much more, probability to react with other chemical groups. As a result, it would form covalent bonds, and without further diffusion to the surroundings. Basically, they are captured. That's what our explanation at this moment. Of course, we need to direct experimental confirmation on this, right?
So I have a comment followed by a question. So, you know, I was in Clinton Bridget's group, and we were doing automation, and because of that, we used a very condensed beam because we wanted to collect a lot of images of individual holes. So our dose rate at 120 kV was 10 times what you're showing, but we still get really good data, like so less than 6 angstroms resolution. So my question is, have you collected your same data with higher dose rates, and could you comment on our observations?
Could you remind me what protein specimen?
It's Gurriel.
Gurriel, yeah. I see. First thing coming to mind is the effect varies from protein to protein. How much damage a protein can sustain, it really varies. Second, for the real application to molecular structure, protein structure, the first application is on TMV, actually, because we have the data ready. And also, by that time, Karsten, who was a former grad student in Nico's group, he was developing a single particle based approach for helical reconstruction. So we applied that technique to make reconstructions on both data sets. And for the first exposure, the linear imaging, the result is comparable to the flood. And for the second exposure, the result is better. So that's one. Experiment fact. And also for the second system comes from the rotavirus, actually. A project is still in progress right now. So my goal is to make a reconstruction of the virus using different imaging techniques and compare them. And to see if the radiation damage would prevent us to reach near close atomic resolution or is it a better imaging protocol would help us to reach there? So this is still a work in progress. Yes.
Okay. Would it help to work at minus 170 instead of minus 180, where diffusion might be faster?
Minus 170.
That is, heat up the specimen a little bit.
I see. That's right. Yes, that's good. Good direction to work on. I haven't done any experiment on that, but I think that's a very good idea. Yes.
Let's have one last question, and perhaps we could move on.
I just have a. I have a comment about the beam-induced movement.
Yes.
You were using gold particles, and I have this image that if I stick a piece of metal in the sun or a piece of biological material, the metal would get hotter faster.
Heat it up.
So could it be that you're heating them up faster? Has you or anyone else tried this same experiment with, say, small ferritin particles or some small biological particle to test movement? Hmm.
I know that Bettina has tried this years ago, measuring what happens if you illuminate just particles in holes, and she says they basically go surfing, and you can watch them move. That seems to be significant.
Okay, one more.
So it's a sort of a general comment and a question. Assuming what you are getting is correct, and the if I remember correct, that in general, for different forms of ionizing radiation, when people do things, do experiment like this, I remember there's a case in gamma radiation and there's a case in X-ray radiation. Okay. In both cases, if your dose rate is higher, your damage is actually lower. So how do you explain that this difference in
electron microscopy.
So if I understand correctly, with a faster rate, you give the radicals less of a chance to react. If is that so, basically, a lower rate would provide more time for the chemical reactions that may or will take place. But I think this is not our interpretation of this effect. The interpretation is more that the bubbling, which you ultimately see, seems to be delayed. So this is sort of a different effect where you seem to accumulate radicals in certain pockets and produce little cracks, and that will then eventually evolve into this bubbling. But if you evolve those radicals at a slower rate, then these cracks evolve more slowly or may not evolve at all. So that's it's not really, that's why I think James said in the beginning. So it's one thing that the damage on the molecular level to the specimen, which we don't know about, maybe it's even worse. But the other is the movement that you induce, and that seems to be less with this technique.
Okay, let's... What?
There's a cap to the mic.
Oh, the little... Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Let's just move on to... In fact, I called James up out of order, so I'm going to back up again and show a couple of drawings which will help Bob introduce his part of the presentation. So here's a sort of diagram of a frozen thin layer containing a biological specimen. Here's the carbon. Here's a hole and the carbon on the other side. Here's the frozen liquid and the ideal specimen, the ideal frozen specimen. And the biological material here represented by these circles is nicely positioned and nicely embedded. It's not too thick, so it minimizes the noise in the background contributed by the ice. And it's not too thin that the ice is impinging upon the biological material and potentially damaging it. So that's the ideal case. What we probably have, somewhat exaggerated, is something like this, where there's variation in thickness across the whole. So what happens when you get a variation in the ice thickness? And I think my belief is that the biological material is sort of pushed into the thicker areas. I mean, many people will say, and I've heard people say, oh, you know, it gets the biological material sticks out of the ice. I don't think that's the case at all. I think surface tension effects are so large and so important at these scales that everything is pushed aside. So your virus or your ribosome is concentrated in thicker areas and pushed out of thinner areas. And up here, where it can't move around because it's attached to the substrate, then it gets damaged. And then you can see, and I'm sure everyone has seen, viruses that have been squashed to such an extent that they are falling apart and the contents are spilling out. So this is the ideal situation. This is the situation in reality. Maybe if there are large hydrophobic patches on the surface of your protein, then they may interact with the surface of the liquid. But generally speaking, I think they get pushed aside from these thinner areas. And there are also weird effects that go on that I don't understand. So one of the specimens that I've worked on over the years is actomyosin, where you have an actin filament with these myosin heads decorating the outside of it. And what I've observed is that if an actin filament, for example, lies across here, you'll have nice decoration here and nice decoration here, but where it gets really thin, then the myosin heads get knocked off the actin filament. And I'm not sure how very thin is. I mean, I don't know if the surface of the liquid needs to get to within 10 angstroms of the myosin to push it off, or whether it needs to get to within 100 angstroms of the myosin to push it off. I think there are effects to do with the surface that I don't understand, and maybe someone in the room can illuminate us if they understand it any better. But there's a lot happening at the surface that's a complete mystery to us. So, Bob, do you want to... continue on and...
So leave it up for a minute.
Okay.
And should I put the...
Yes.
I'm not going to discuss this one. That you can look around the grid and find areas of ice that are various thicknesses. So since we think this is probably more ideal than that, let's look around.
around the grid until we find an area that we think.
That looks like that cartoon down there. Sorry. Should have clipped this on first. So, just one second, yeah, just to remind you, and for dramatic effect, of course. If we look at this picture, that is what I truly, you know, believe in my heart, or wish in my heart, that our samples were like that. But recently, my lab has been starting to do some cryo-EM. You would have thought I've done it, you know, all my life, but just recently we've started to do it. And pretty much, much if not all of our experience forces me to say this is not what actually happens, even if you look for the areas. And so I have two slides that make comments in response to the rhetorical question, what is wrong with this picture? You know, it's a nice picture. What's wrong with it? Why weren't any of the proteins, you know, shown as being spread out or denatured at the air-water interface? So if you have a protein solution that's 1 mg per ml, and you're a biochemist, you're extremely careful, you know, not to shake it too much or stir it too much because you get bubbles, and those bubbles are stable. And if you have a really precious sample you've been able to crank up to 1 mg per ml, which is what you'd like to do for a cryo-EM sample, and you don't think your protein's going to denature at the air-water interface, I'll give you a demonstration. So why is the foam at the top of a protein sample, you know, if you bubble some air through it, you know, you make thin aqueous films, why is that thin film of water that then has the protein denatured at it and makes a stable bubble, why is that any different from the one that we drew as our ideal sample? Rhetorical question. I'm worried. So you might say, well, the difference is that I blot it and half a second later I plunge, freeze it. Now, another rhetorical question. How long does it take for diffusion to give our particles at least one chance to hit the air-water interface when the particle is confined to a film that is only 3 to 5 particle diameters thick, less than a millisecond? Proteins have plenty of chances to collide with the air-water interface after you've blotted. And in particular, if you blot from both sides, you make clean interfaces on both sides. You make this thin film. If your protein constant is high, I guess I expect to have a lot of proteins spread. Now, examples that I know of where labs believe that particles are really destroyed by interaction with the air-water interface is nucleosomes, notoriously difficult, like the actomyosin that Ron mentioned. So I wish I'd known about that. I would have added it on as a fourth thing that seems to be destroyed by interaction. Pyruvate ferredoxin oxidoreductase is the one that we worked in our lab. And Florin Garchek, who was a postdoc with Ivan Agalis, got a beautiful 3D reconstruction in air-dried ammonium molybdate negative stain going to 17 angstrom resolution. The known X-ray structure for the dimer docked into the octamer structure, really a lot better than OJ's hand went into the glove during his trial. Another rhetorical question, what experimental data do we in fact have to indicate that most proteins fail to denature at the air-water interface? I guess I don't have it, but I was starting to tell about the pyruvate ferredoxin oxidoreductase, which that makes this beautiful particle preparation in negative stain. And when Florian tried to make cryo samples, he could find only the really rare scattered particle that looked like it was an octamer and a whole lawn of little uniformly sized guys that we're pretty sure were dimers. So the air-water interface, I can't understand how it would happen, but I think the air-water interface actually pulls things apart. It's not just random Brownian motion of the particle, but surface tension really is a force, and it grabs a hold of the protein here, just like an atomic tweezers experiment. It grabs one part of the protein, grabs the other, and just pulls it apart. It rips it. I think that if I knew that happened, then I would that would explain the observations. Why do some particles have such faint contrast? They look like particles, but the contrast is a half or a third. It's got the right outline and everything. So the icosahedral enzyme complex that Richard showed, you can see nice examples of this. Okay, continued. What is wrong with that picture that's behind on the board there? A reality check is that if you take your protein at a known concentration in grams per milliliter, so a milligram per ml, that number would be 10 to the minus 3, take a protein at a known concentration and make your sample and measure the mean distance, the typical characteristic distance between particles, measure it in units of a particle diameter. And if that distance L is not the same number as is given by this simple formula, the 0.5 is 1 over the square root of 4. So we assume the thickness of the ice is 4 times the particle diameter. That's where the 0.5 comes from. This is the mass density of protein, also in grams per milliliter, grams per cubic centimeter. So if this characteristic distance in units of the size of the particle itself doesn't match this, then we need to ask ourselves, if this distance, if you have more particles than this formula, then either you started with a layer of water that was much thinner and you evaporated a lot for the rapid evaporation that Ron was talking about, so that you concentrated the sample by evaporation, and therefore you have more per unit area, they're closer to each other. Either it evaporated, or the particles have actually adsorbed to the interface without becoming at least completely damaged. On the other hand, if the average distance between particles is much greater than this formula, then it means that either the particles have all adsorbed to the carbon support film and there's none left to be in the holes, or the particles have denatured at the air-water interface and essentially gone away. So I thought that maybe the most helpful thing or useful take-home lesson of these two slides is to, when you know the protein concentration you apply and you know the thickness roughly of the ice in terms of the size of your particle, just count the number of particles and see, as a reality check, whether it's the right number or whether some of these additional complications might be going on. So those are the things that I think are wrong with what we whistle in the dark and hope the sample preparation really is. With nitrogen.
Yeah, something that, so you wouldn't have air water.
It's the same thing. Yeah.
Something that's not.
No one knows what that something should be. Yeah, so it's a really good suggestion to check whether things are sticking to the air-water interfaces due to tomography. And I forget who did it, but and Ken will add to what I'm going to say, but I saw something recently, a year or two ago, of tomography done on clathrin cages in cryo. And for that lab, they're all at the air-water interface, one or the other.
My impression is that in fact, that is where most of the proteins are, at one interface or the other, more than being in the middle.
I talked to another lab, and I think they told me that they do tomography, and they're all like in the cartoon where that I'm saying what's wrong with the picture. I know that Ken... Yeah, now before there's a couple of other cut. Well, yeah. So before there's other comments, the technique Debbie just told about is the absolute perfect remedy to this. Adsorb them to a nice affinity chromatography surface so they won't see the air-water interface, they won't get damaged. Blot. They won't be able to diffuse off and hit the other air-water interface, so we're saved. But thank you, Debbie, just in time.
But
yeah. Yeah.
We are dealing with hemocyanins, and in our preparation, we saw often that the hemocyanins are aggregated on the edges, and in the middle, everything is free, direct clearance. If you have a concave layer of the film, then the proteins automatically are pushed outside on the edge. And we also see from the orientation of the proteins that they are inside the eyes. May I do a little drawing again?
You want to go on the board there? Or? Yeah, when there's preferred orientation, that's a really big signal. Yeah.
But it seems that lumping all proteins into one behavior is not really smart, because we know, from biochemistry that some proteins act one way and some another. So
yeah, very good point. Yeah. Somebody in back first.
Is it blasphemy to suggest that you add something to lower the surface tension here?
Well, we sure tried a lot and it didn't help. Jacques Dubuchet tried, and at a moment he thought that he had the thing to save nucleosomes, but a couple of years later he said, no, it's not reproducible, and it's not worth talking about. The detergents would be a good thing. They're small molecules. They zip up there very fast, but apparently they can be pushed aside and displaced pretty easily, and the protein still muscles its way in. We tried beta casein, a nice surfactant protein, a couple of other things. Didn't make one bit of difference. We still blew apart our complex.
Maybe Derby can do it further. I'm wondering if you can do sandwich method, like using two monolayers so that the protein is in between the two monolayers and avoid this surface problem.
a lipid monolayer sandwich. That's a good idea. You know, somebody might have said, you know, why not use a carbon sandwich, or why not adsorb proteins to carbon? The P4 we worked with looked pretty sick when adsorbed to carbon. So it was, you know, the same idea as adsorbing it to the lipid monolayer, but activated charcoal is, even when it's been made hydrophilic, isn't friendly to all proteins.
One of the things people should think about is what's determining the thickness of the ice that you're going to be imaging your sample in. One of the things that I've observed, and this was in an experiment where I was trying to do a time-resolved experiment, it was with a virus. What I wanted to do was put in another virus as a counting control, and they were distinctly different-sized viruses. This completely failed because they very nicely sorted into their own holes on the grid. In where the larger virus was, you had thick ice. Where you had the smaller virus, you got thin ice. And it seems that quite often that the ice thickness is being determined by the sample.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing the same thing now trying to do tomography with small bacterial cells, is that the thickness of the ice in very nearby can be quite thin, but in the location of the bacteria, it matches, of course, the bacteria.
Debbie?
I don't know. It seems to me with trying on these different parameters, the simplest thing that you can get to work works best. And the Clathrin single particle tomography was elegantly done with Yifan Chen and Tom's group, and the results of that were quite nice. But getting back to this, I have no idea how to envision particles in between two monolayers unless you would have one and then put, I don't know how you would actually do that conceptually. That's something to think about, or put carbon film. But basically, if you can, as you said, have the layer, the monolayer, even on purified protein, you can just lift up a purified protein that would be actually be in the sample trough to control the thickness of the ice by blotting time. You can blot. It would take a really large effort to blot to get them extremely dry. You can actually control the thickness of the ice quite nicely. Just with the blotting time to have a homogeneous distribution in the ice. So monolayer, even on purified specimen, might actually be beneficial to pull the sample away from the air-water interface and actually localize it further down into the ice. But I'm not exactly sure the level at which the monolayer is embedded in the ice. That's not a fact, but I haven't seen huge problems with that, actually, with what I've done. But thanks for the plug.
You deserve it. Ken.
Grid up through a monolayer on Langmuir-Blodgett trough, but the problem with that would be is that the Langmuir-Blodgett trough is fairly large area, and so you would have to be able to get a lot of specimen to do that. So whereas now the monolayer stuff, you know, you don't need much to make specimen at all. So I think it would negate that beauty of the single monolayer.
And as I've been thinking, if the protein is bound to the lipid monolayer, and then you blot away the water and you have a fresh air-water interface, it isn't hurting anything. The protein is out of reach, and so you don't really need the second layer. Well, so I have about 45 minutes worth of other slides on the question of radiation damage, and I expect you probably don't want to hear it right now, but I can show it any time you like, you can go away with a happier feeling that things aren't as bad as a pessimist might say they are. So I leave it up to the chair to decide.
Well, I think we can go on for another 15 minutes.
Let's see how quickly I can zoom through it.
Summarize.
I'm sure many of you either know this or had this experience yourself, that specimen movement varies over the area of a single micrograph. This is a micrograph from Albany of ice-embedded ribosomes. You can't see it. It's really low mag. Uncontinuous carbon. And Richard Hall, who's in my group, took the boxed particles. It's on carbon, so you can see tone rings. You can hardly see the tone rings, but instead of classifying the images, he classified the tone rings. and then he looked at the class averages. And you get class averages that look like that. Or this one is pretty good. That one looks as good, but it has a worse B factor. That one's not drifting as much as that one. And you know, every micrograph is different pattern. And it's not stage drift that you're looking at. It's beam-induced large-scale drift. And as the color coding indicates, the particles that were classified by their tone patterns, you know, cluster according to kind of tone. So it's a whole area of the specimen that's moving one way and another one that's fairly stationary. Richard and Nigel told my group many, many years ago that the thicker you make the carbon, the less you have this effect. And people going for high resolution always want the thinnest possible carbon. All right. So beam-induced motion is real, even if you don't tilt the sample. And I'd say that 99% of the images are going to show pretty obnoxious beam-induced motion like that. So a rhetorical question. Does the cryo-EM community accept that this beam-induced motion movement is a major limitation that's impeding our effort to get high resolution? The effect of the limitation can be quantified, and Richard Henderson mentioned some of this. Nigel and Richard did it in their very first paper on Bacter adoption, and a decade or so after that, I was on sabbatical leave, and one of the things I did together with Richard is to look at the ratio of the strength of the signal for a given diffraction spot to the strength of the average intensity, F0, FG to F0 ratio. And it varied for vermiculite, which is not so radiation sensitive. You know, it was about 25% for crystalline paraffin at 4 angstrom resolution. These are the same resolution. It was about 5%, but going up to 10%. Purple membrane, it depends on the resolution. And here's much more recent work from Yoshi's lab showing the FG to F, well, this is the intensities, but I converted it to amplitudes, and it steadily falls off. There's occasionally some good guys. The X's are things that they recommended. One ought to be careful about believing them for other reasons. All right, so now, is this movement due to physical movement of the specimen, or is it due to some electron optical effect due to charging? It's terribly important to know that if we want to find a solution, but which one is correct is irrelevant to saying it does happen. And that's why I like to say, instead of saying charging, I like to say beam-induced motion. So again, I'm really hitting the point pretty obnoxiously to ask, does the community accept that this beam-induced motion occurs all of the time, even when we consider the best images? I think they'd say no. But I say yes, obviously. All right, so to what extent does the community support the need for research that might improve this ratio? I also know the answer to that. Yes?
See whether they move anyway.
wait 5 minutes before taking the first picture, you mean?
No.
I'm pulling your chain. All right. So whatever the correct interpretation of that question is, my answer, unfortunately, is no, I haven't done it. I'm struggling, actually, because I often get asked that question, and I'm struggling to wrap my mind around how to do that. But let's not talk about it. Let's talk about dinner or something, because I was supposed to get through this quickly. David doesn't like that. So from experience, I know a lot of people won't know how one experimentally measures the ratio of the amplitude of the structure factor at a certain resolution to the amplitude of the incident beam. And Medipix is a superb way to do this. This is an image of an electron diffraction pattern where we have not focused it to a sharp spot. We've sort of, like Zernike, decided it's better to defocus it a little bit. So the defocused electron diffraction pattern, paraffin crystals are little diamonds. You see that every diffraction spot is a diamond. Some are pretty weak. And I don't know how clearly you can see, but in this same exposure, which looks like it's saturated, Medipic says, I'm happy as a clam. Just, you know, change the threshold. You're looking at, you can see the bright field image of the crystal. So you can actually, this is a digital detector, so you know how many counts per pixel are in the unscattered beam for a given number of pixels, and you can do it here. And the nice thing about these images, you notice how uniformly intense they are, except for the electron shot noise when it gets noisy. So that means these crystals are really, really flat. And you then compute the ratio of the measured intensities, take square root, and you compute the ratio Ft to F0 for the diffraction pattern. Then you record an image and compute its Fourier transform. And again, you can, from the computed value, get Fg to F0. And the two should be identical. Theory demands a factor of two that I'm suppressing for the sake of simplicity. If you do the theory correctly, they should be, in that sense, identical numbers. And in this apparently beautiful image of the quasi-hexagonal located diffraction spots of paraffin, we're getting 13%. That's a really good image, or it's a really bad image, depending on your point of view. It should be 1.0. So the signal is there in the diffracted wave. It's not there in the image. It's gone away someplace. And so we say generically, that is beam-induced motion. The signal was not going away in the wait time. It was going away in the measurement. There wasn't as much signal in the measurement as there should be. Now, if you tilt the sample, and this is a result, again, from Yoshi's lab that's in the literature, I'm not sure how clearly you can see it, shows that if you tilt to 60 degrees or something like that, you get a nice population of very sharp diffraction spots, more or less parallel to the tilt axis, but perpendicular to the tilt axis. They go away. And so image resolution is systematically degraded in the direction of the tilt axis. Many of you knew that before. Some of you noticed it was mentioned earlier already in the workshop. Now, engage in my scenario for a moment, even though you have no reason to do so. If we suppose that electrostatic deflection of the image is ruled out, then the only other alternative explanation that I'm able to think of is that there is some kind of drumhead motion, that during irradiation, the sample is bending and buckling and writhing and twisting and so forth. Now, I could have put in another slide that if we have crystals of like valine amino acid that show beautiful bend contours even when you're not tilted, as you irradiate, these bend contours swim and spread around all over the place. Yoshi is confirming that this is true long before the diffraction pattern fades. So that sample, we do know that buckling and bending of the organic sample is occurring. And so that is certainly an alternative we have to keep in mind when we want to explain beam-induced motion. It doesn't have to be charging. Furthermore, this drumhead motion is not just room vibrate. You installed the microscope, and the manufacturer said you have to have not more than 1 micrometer amplitude floor vibration. And of course, that's going to propagate up into the column and cause some fluctuation. So this is a graphite test specimen recorded on the research microscope at Berkeley at 70 degrees tilt. And it's not going like this. It's absolutely rock still. So the alternative hypothesis that I believe, and I'm not sure I'll have time to fully defend my belief, but nevertheless, here's my belief. The alternative is that radiation damage in beam-sensitive specimens results in stress, and that's the culprit. You're generating pressure within the sample by causing radiation damage, and that stress is causing buckling and bending and fluctuations like drumhead motions. Okay. So, so one thing that Dieter Tipke did a while ago is took the electron dose that paraffin will tolerate at low temperature, 20 electrons per square angstrom, divided it into 40 exposures, each of them half an electron per square angstrom. This is paraffin. These are experiments you can only do with paraffin because the diffraction is so strong. There's so much signal. And every one of these pictures showed the paraffin spots. And Ken Downing applied the unbending, and frame after frame after frame, the unbending pattern was different in every one of them. If you corrected for unbending using this pattern, the spots sharpened up a lot. If you took this correction and applied it to that image, they actually got broader. So the unbending pattern is different between each successive frame. If you used all 20 electrons per square angstrom to record an image, you would have a the composite of all of this. You're itching to ask me the right question, but I'm not going to let you. Another thing that Ken did is he looked at the phase origin of the crystal lattice in each frame relative to aligning all of them by the carbon film phase contrast granularity. So all the images were aligned, and then he asked, where's the phase origin? It's doing the most beautiful random walk. That could be much bigger steps than this, because the phase origin is determined only modulo the unit cell. So this is the most conservative amount of movement of the crystal. So there is beam-induced motion. This is an untilted sample. Now, it's a true statement that beam-induced motion, it's likely that it's caused by pressure, by damage-induced stress. And the reason I say that is that a solid-state chemist who is studying some organic chemical that I don't remember the name of was illuminating this crystal with probably UV light that caused photolysis and caused a solid-state chemical reaction. And when 5% of the molecules had been photolyzed, he found that the pressure inside the crystal was half the amount of pressure that converts graphite to diamond. So we're in the wrong business. We should be, making diamonds, not trying to take high-resolution images. The explanation he proposed is that radiolysis produces fragments and some structural rearrangement, and these fragments no longer fit into the cavity that corresponds to the original size and shape. So please put it on your radar screen that charging is a real thing that happens, but also radiolysis-induced mechanical stress is a thing that happens.
If that's the case, Bob, then a large crystal should be much more damaged than a small crystal.
Well, I think I might be coming to a related point. Ron is saying if you have a really large crystal and you're radiating the whole thing, there might be more damage. I'm going to try to pick that up, and if I don't respond to it in the way you're thinking about, elaborate a little bit. So this is another unpublished result from my sabbatical leave a number of years ago in Cambridge. Here is the calculated Fourier transform of an image recorded on film with spot scan illumination. So in spite of all of these, Richard had a nice slide of optimist and pessimist. And you might wonder, right now you might think I'm a pessimist, but I'm really an optimist. And there are indications that the combination of spot scan and stable and making more stable support films, together, both of them can make a contribution, and you want to use both contributions to reducing beam-induced motion. So this image of paraffin, these strong spots are at around 4 angstrom resolution. So this spot is at, 1.86. And can you see the spots at 1.7? You just look along the lattice and you go perpendicular to the axes. There's one there and there's one there. Richard tells me he's just applied unbending to it and he can see spots to 1.5 angstrom resolution. That whatever went right to make this image good should be reproducible. It's something physically, something in the physical world happened to give you an image that's good. If we only understood what it was, it should be possible for us to engineer a design such that most images would be as good as this. Incidentally, I'm going to make if I tell you it's a joke, then you won't find that it's funny. But anyway, this image was recorded with an exposure time of about 30 million seconds. No, no, 30 milliseconds. There, I got it right that time. So. because it's spot scan, so each exposure was really fast. So the world is really complicated. And our goal as scientists should be to understand it and to have the skill to exploit what we understand, if necessary, know the art of doing things like specimen preparation, but to never rely on luck and to never open your mouth and generate BS. So we should be on the science and skill side and not on the other side of things. All right, so having said that, I've probably issued a lot of BS during the workshop so far, even though I'm not aware of it. All right, so there are actually two flavors. One is clueless, and the other is charlatan. And I don't think that I'm guilty of the charlatan side, but I can't say that I understand everything, and that puts you in trouble. All right, so why does spot scan work on samples that are on continuous carbon but fail for self-support? So WASLAB showed a number of years ago, I think it was Jaap Brink, that if you try to use spot scan on a sample that's self-supported over a hole, the images are a lot worse than if you use flood beam. And that's because, as Nigel knows, that for a self-supported specimen, the electron beam has to touch the carbon film. Ideally, touch the carbon film symmetrically. But why is that? Well, charging really is severe for specimens that are not prepared on carbon, or if they're not carbon-coated. that kind of charging, if you take a plastic section that's on a grid and not on carbon and not carbon-coated, it charges really, really incredibly. If you put in an objective aperture, you hardly see the charging. So an objective aperture certainly minimizes charging, but I personally doubt that the charging is prevented completely if you use an objective aperture. So what did I say? I don't even know what that So it's time to go have something to eat, I think. I'm getting to the point that mechanical stress the point is what it has related anyway to the question of why does spot scan seem to work if you have the sample on carbon film, either you prepared it on carbon film or you evaporate carbon on it after you prepared it. And you can all do the following experiment with a nice piece of paper that's been crumpled in some way. This one happened to be crumpled because I like to carry paper in my pocket. I once read that if you don't carry paper in your pocket, God will give your idea to someone else. So that's what I think carbon film looks like when you pick it up from water and it's sitting on the grid. Well, that's maybe exaggerated, but I think it isn't perfectly flat. It's a bit crumpled. And it touches the grid bar at least three points, maybe more. And then if somebody comes along and touches a place where it bulges, those of you close by can see it moves way over there. So if I'm trying to look here and get an image, if I'm trying to look here and get an image, and I'm irradiating there, but I'm also irradiating here and I generate mechanical stress, it's going to move. Whereas if I just illuminate there, I'll still have the same effect, but not as much of it. So That's a conjecture. I don't know that that's true. I don't even know if it's testable. But before we can come up with testable hypotheses, we at least have to formulate some hypotheses. And that was meant to answer the question you raised about irradiating a big crystal rather than a small one. And I think that's all I have to say right now.
And or Nigel to make a comment on something that was said this morning, and that was to do with this diagram here. So this, the red circle is a hole in the carbon film, and there's a specimen across it here. And my understanding was that it was really necessary to irradiate, to spread the beam such that the entire circumference of the hole was irradiated. Under those conditions, you would get minimal charging or beam-induced specimen movement. But I think, Yoshi, you said that, you know, if even in this instance here where only half the hole is being irradiated, that now you've solved the problem and that...
Yeah.
So what... Do you want to describe how that solves the problem or how you've solved the problem?
One of you?
Both of you? They're both pointing at each other.
The thing is, it takes some time. There's a lot of things that you have to take care of to reduce beam movement. In our experience, using Yoshi's microscope, and could I just summarize the sort of it's gone. It started in 1995, actually, when Ramin and I visited Yoshi, and we started to take pictures of. I can do it here. Tubes over holes, and I think the first two visits we took 200 images each time, and not one of them was absolutely stationary. Not one of them was good, and our first discussion was that. The way to fix that was to make sure that we had a very clean gold aperture because, you know, one realizes from studies of the phase plate a long time ago that the scattering, the electrons, when they hit the gold aperture, they emit secondary electrons which cancel out the positive charge that's generated at the level of the specimen. And when we did that, certainly we started to get one or two good images, but that still wasn't good enough. And so one of the next things we did was to have symmetrical imaging over holes. And the thing is, the carbon emits secondary electrons rather like the gold aperture and cancels out some of the charge that is generated in the ice. So if you have it all the way around the hole, you're using as much carbon as you can. And also, because it's a symmetrical situation, if there's going to be movement, it doesn't know which way to move because, it's all pulled potentially equally in all directions. That didn't completely... that worked sometimes, but not all the time. And then our next experience was that pre-irradiating grids made a big difference. Improving the conductivity of the carbon film made a big difference. And then every time we could get good pictures when we had a symmetrical situation and even get good pictures when we didn't have a symmetrical situation sometimes. But even then, we had problems for a year or so, and Yoshi sort of solved it accidentally, didn't you? By redesigning the stage and having metal in different parts, so you can explain it, so you get more backscattering to cancel out the charge that's generated, and once with a better microscope, clean column, more backscattering from the parts of the microscope as well as the aperture, as well as using high conductivity films that also produce secondary electrons, we don't ever see I think overholes any. Evidence for movement, visually at least. every picture seems to be fine.
Is it perfect?
No. We don't know perfect or not, so maybe not.
What I would say is if we took a batch of 36 pictures of tubes over holes, none of them would show tone ring patterns that showed evidence for movement. One could get that far. Yeah, of course, that's like going out to 8 angstroms or something like that. Yes, so that's why one couldn't answer that absolutely with certainty.
And I want to add a comment as well, if I can have the mic back.
So there, some of us will be motivated to know, is charging a factor or not? Others won't care. If there's an operational procedure and my images are better, then I'm going to use that better procedure, and that's totally legitimate. But for the subset who want to know about charging, I have a background question and then a suggestion. The background question is, can you see the Behrmann effect occurring in your sample? Because that certainly is a charging phenomenon. And if you can, then my question is the Behrmann effect less if you use pre-irradiated carbon, or is the Behrmann effect less if you use an ultra-clean gold aperture? In my experience, and I actually slipped one past an editor, Ken and I wrote a paper about charging and whether it is a problem or not. And one of the sections in this paper is, well, first of all, the Behrmann effect is kind of a subjective thing. You see it or not, we rarely quantify it. But so I wrote a section that said, an objective aperture has no subjective effect on the Behrmann effect. corrects me, let me add the qualifier that this is for an insulating specimen on a carbon film.
Okay, I think my experience is, at least under nickel helium conditions, I think both Nigel and Yoshi's are absolutely correct. In other words, once we have a dirty aperture, no problem, we see Aegon ISO, no problem, even at a dirty aperture. But anything beyond that, we cannot go beyond that.
That's another effect. So if you have a dirty aperture, then your tone rings beyond nine, whatever, aren't even circular or elliptical. They're square.
Well, it's not really. Well, some of them.
Isn't that right, Yoshi?
I think they are definitely a kind of some sort.
Yeah, I cannot clearly answer. So I don't know. So yeah. So
Yoshi, could
those of you who are not familiar with Japanese culture, to the little extent that I am, is that if a colleague, Japanese colleague, says maybe, he's really saying in English, no, that's wrong.
Yoshi, could I ask you to tell us what you did to your microscope?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'm afraid audience will confuse, and because I don't know why. So very strangely, we change the shielding size of aperture when we change the dramatically beam induced movement is changed. So just size of shield.
But I think it is a fair request to say that anything that's being used to reduce charging and beam-induced motion, to ask, does it have an observable effect on how big the Behrmann effect is? That would be informative.
I don't know pre-irradiated carbon, but in case of double symmetrical specimen proportion, double carbon is exactly same.
The same Behrmann effect.
Yes,
right?
Same Behrmann effect. And I measured another way, but and very similar. So data is very similar. Yeah. So that is clear. But I don't know pre-irradiated. I didn't measure. So very funny thing is when just change the shielding aperture, and then it's reproducibly dramatically changed. I confirmed. And then all our my design microscope is changed to the size, accurate size. So.
And I think my appeal is that instead of always assuming that's due to charging or solving charging, ask whether an alternative explanation is that for some reason the sample is the grid is, the support film is mechanically more stable. So one of the things I love about the carbon sandwich between grid bars, and I would draw it that it comes down symmetrically from both sides, is that then to get this to vibrate like a drum head, you have to work against the compression modulus or the stretch modulus. It's much more difficult to cause this guy to flex. So the mechanical explanation might actually be a more promising explanation than to say that charging has been solved.